Our guest is focused on strengthening family physicians and the communities they care for, but their members are navigating unprecedented and challenging issues coming out of Washington.
Certainly, we are reaching a different tipping point in the process, and that process is going to ultimately start to really have an impact on a large number of American families. So we continue to push for them to get to the negotiating table and open the government.
Our guest today is Sean Martin. He is the CEO of the American Academy of Family Physicians. This is one of the largest national medical organizations with over 128,000 members in the U.S. and around the world.
I would encourage them to think about the families that are being impacted. And certainly there are issues that are a part of the shutdown or a part of the negotiation that are going to impact about 20 to 22 million families.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome, Sean, to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Mark and Margaret, thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be with you today.
Yeah. And speaking of today, the government shutdown continues. And yet on November 1st, about 25 states are set to pause SNAP benefits due to the shutdown. Obviously, this is going to threaten food assistance for millions of vulnerable families. What's the AFFP's position on the shutdown?
Well, I mean, I think we continue to encourage House and Senate members to find common ground, to reopen the government, and then have meaningful debates on some key issues that we and they all care about, including affordability of healthcare. But certainly we are reaching a different tipping point in the process, and that process is going to ultimately start to really have an impact on a large number of American families. So we continue to push for them to get to the negotiating table and open the government and then proceed with their difficult conversations that need to take place.
It seems like there's a stalemate because the Democrats at this point, I think there's a lack of trust that's happening down in Washington, really can't trust the decision of closing first and then having a vote on it. What's your advice to them in terms of how we can find some common ground?
Well, I think first and foremost, I would encourage them to think about the families that are being impacted. And certainly there are issues that are a part of the shutdown or a part of the negotiation that are going to impact about 20 to 22 million families. There are issues that need to be discussed and resolved that impact affordability and access to healthcare. But I think the message we continue to convey is that those discussions need to take place in a bipartisan way. But they also need to take the appropriate steps to make sure American families aren't significantly hurt or impacted. And food insecurity, making food insecurity worse, is not a means to a better tomorrow for a lot of families.
And I'm sure your hearings, I heard this weekend in a panel discussion, Mark, that I was on, that the emergency food shelters and food banks are all feeling the same pressure. There's a downward pressure from all of this, and that, of course, affects patients in the exam room. So I'm sure your members are hearing a lot about that. I know you're asked to consider some very challenging issues. You recently called on President Trump to reconsider Secretary Kennedy's ability to serve as the HHS secretary. Can you share with us, I'm sure there's a lot of discussion about that, what led to that decision, and what do you say to your AAFP members who might not think that was the wisest course of action?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, these are all very difficult, you know, conversations that take place over weeks and months as we evaluate the effectiveness of the federal government and state governments for that matter. I think the thing really had less to do with the policies that the secretary was pursuing, although that was a critical factor in our thinking, and really more to do with the fact that the American public, through a variety of polls over a very consistent period of time dating back to the late spring, is expressing a real concern and confidence with respect to the efficacy and messaging of the federal government. And the letter was very pointed in this space, that the secretary seems to have lost the trust of the American people, and steps should be taken to either A, restore that trust, or B, find someone that can establish that trust in a new way. And since the secretary reports to the president, we felt it was most appropriate to ask the president to make that evaluation.
John, let's pull the thread in one of those hot button issues for Secretary Kennedy has been the claims of a link between vaccines and autism. Just wondering, is this one of the drivers for your members dealing with the questions and concerns that they're hearing from their patients?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a great deal of confusion in the exam room. There's certainly a great deal of confusion in our communities, around our kitchen tables, at our school PTA groups. I mean, the sowing of doubt around the efficacy of vaccines is an issue that we're very concerned about. And the AAFP and other physician organizations certainly understand and want to be alongside families that are impacted by autism and finding and seeking information that can help other families not have to deal with that in their children in the future. But we can't assign blame or assign convenient blame in our pursuit of those answers. So one, we are deeply empathetic to the families that are searching for answers, but we also understand that vaccines have been one of the most efficient public health strategies the country has ever had. And many children over the course of the past several decades are alive because of vaccines. So there's a balance there, and messaging matters, and being honest and truthful really matters when you're talking about issues that are deeply personal to American families.
Well, it's hard to have a conversation with anybody in healthcare without talking about vaccines right now, both the time of the year that we're in and all these policy decisions. There's also been concerns put out there about MMRV, the measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox or varicella vaccines for children. I know your organizations probably, or your members, are asked to take stands on these various controversy. What kind of advice do you give to members, or do you rely on people to exercise their own discretion in how they respond, either to inquiries from the media, the public, and of course, in the exam room, it's more one-to-one.
No, that's a great question. We are a resource to our members. We publish a vaccine schedule every year for both children, adults, and pregnant individuals. And we do a review of literature and science and recommendation from other organizations. And we assemble a front and back a vaccine recommendation for our members to use in their practices. I think that MMR is an interesting space where the AAFP for the past several years has recommended for children under the age of one that the chickenpox vaccine be separated and administered separately and independently from the MMR vaccine. So we're not that far off of the recommendation that came out of ACIP. Now, in the event that a parent would seek to have one visit and one vaccine, then we think the ability or the importance of the vaccine should be administered in one dose if you run the risk of not being able to administer both doses. We encourage our members, we try to resource our members, I guess is the way I would say it, with information. We ask them to enter those conversations with a tremendous amount of grace, work with their patients, answer their questions. They're really on a journey with these families and patients over a period of time. I don't think guilt is an effective public health strategy, and I say this all the time. Guilt closes doors, grace keeps conversations going, and I think we just continue to encourage our members to be good advocates and be on a longitudinal healthcare journey with these individuals and families.
Great way to say it. I like that.
It absolutely
grace
is.
Opens doors.
And let's talk a little bit about that journey they're on with their patients. They're certainly having to address the dramatic changes in HR1, which includes over $1 trillion in future cuts to healthcare programs. And the AAFP is developing strategies really to help those physicians adapt to the new policies and potential effects on patients. Tell us a little more about your strategy here and how you're advising your members.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, strategy is a generous term right now. I think we are still in the understanding phase. I think we're very much trying to comprehend and understand what happened in H.R. 1. And obviously, we understand the provisions of the bill. I don't think we've really developed sound positions on what the impacts are going to be and the sequencing of those impacts over the next couple of years. There's going to be compounding effects, if you will, due to a variety of policies that were in that bill. I think the one thing that we're focused on right now, because it's the most timely issue, is really optimizing the impact of the Rural Health Transformation Fund, making sure that states and family physicians and all the states and territories are working with their state leaders to put together proposals that would benefit rural family medicine and primary care practices to the extent possible, given the needs of the state. But optimizing those dollars to rural family medicine is really our priority for the next few weeks until those applications are due. Moving forward, obviously, a lot of people are going to lose Medicaid coverage. Other people are going to have transition periods between Medicaid and Medicare if they were dual eligibles. There's a lot of impacts with the children's health program, people moving off eligibility of Medicaid, particularly onto CHIP or vice versa. Lots and lots of reasons to be concerned. I think still lots of places that we need to better understand the impact, but taking $1 trillion out of the healthcare system, it goes without saying that we're deeply concerned about that.
Well, and I would imagine you're going to have practitioners where the issues around work requirements are going to have a lot of people coming, talking to whatever health condition they might have to see if there can be some assistance there in trying to articulate out their capability for doing work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. I mean, you're going to have an administrative task that didn't exist that's going to be put in place. I think there is hope amongst federal and state policymakers and regulators that maybe some technology will help make that easier. But our physicians are going to be asked to communicate on a variety of issues related to eligibility. And that's going to, be another process on top of the processes that already exist as they try to help their patients and communities. That's a very good point.
Well, we did have the deputy secretary for CMS on, who said they were trying to make an app that makes it friendly and easy. That's easier to say than to do, but that's what they're at least hopeful that they'll be able to roll something out in the near future.
Yeah. Sean, I wonder if I could go back a minute. You referenced the Rural Transformation Bill and that opportunity. And, family practice has a relatively short and really wonderful history in the United States, right? Am I remembering the certification is 60 years old, maybe?
So we came in to be around 1969, 1970s when our board certification started. Right. Family practice was known as general practice, for many decades prior to that.
Right. And again, a distinguished history. And it's my sense that we live in a very family practice strong area, have one of the earliest family medicine residency programs right here in Connecticut, one of the ones that really emphasizes obstetrics and comprehensive care. But my understanding is that our family practice physicians in the healthcare system really are the backbone of the rural areas and disproportionately maybe located in those rural areas. What are they hoping to see? What are you hoping to see with the Rural Transformation Fund in terms of really advancing primary care and family practice access and delivery in those areas?
Yeah, well, that list is really long, so I'll give you the abbreviated version of it. So I think one is practice stability. I think family physicians and family medicine practices in rural communities, just due to the demographics of the communities they serve, they are more reliant upon public health programs, being Medicare and Medicaid. So creating some type of economic stability for those practices is really important. I think the other thing which is often overlooked is the relationship between the family physician and the hospital and the pharmacy and the nursing home and hospice services in those communities. It's an ecosystem, a tiny ecosystem that is really reliant upon each other. So family physicians need the local pharmacy to be vibrant. They need the community access hospital or the rural hospital to be functioning. That is what helps that ecosystem maintain some balance and some ability to provide comprehensive services. What we are really pointing towards is creating support for these rural practices beyond financial support. So one of the things in states, particularly Western states, is they are very isolated. I think a lot of us that spend time on the East Coast forget how big these states are. And, you know, sending somebody, we are headquartered in Kansas City, but if you're in Western Kansas, you know, you're about 5 hours from Denver and about 5 or 6 hours from Kansas City. They are really isolated. And creating the ability to provide healthcare services through technology, or other types of means to help those communities provide the most comprehensive care to other patients is really important. And those are some areas that, you know, we're trying to be creative and innovative around.
Well, speaking about being vibrant and financial stability, I think AFP and so many others have been focused in on what the country's primary care spend is. It's been too small for too long. But I want to focus in on how Medicare reimburses doctors, which may seem a little obscure when we're talking about primary care, but it's incredibly important. The Trump administration's proposed changes to the Medicare physician's fee schedule, and you're encouraged by us by that those changes. Tell us a little more about your thinking.
Well, yeah, we've been pretty honest. Washington's a weird town, right? There are things that we don't like that are taking place inside HHS, and there are things that we do like. And this is an area where we think the administration is really continuing some of its good policy that they pursued in the first term. And a lot of that is around, you know, enhancing payments to primary care or primary care services through the Medicare physician fee schedule. And they're doing that in a couple of ways. One is really taking a harder look and putting money behind longitudinal care through a program called the Advanced Primary Care Management Code. Wonky term, but it basically means a payment to help physicians maintain a longitudinal relationship with each Medicare patient. That relationship and longitudinal nature of that relationship is really advantageous to patients. Lots of data supports that. The other thing they're doing is really taking a hard look about how physicians are paid globally. And every physician service is assigned a value. Those values are impacted by each other through a relativity methodology. That pool of money is impacted by what's called a budget neutrality provision. And I think to their credit, Dr. Oz and the CMS team are saying, is this the right way? And if it's not the right way, how might we think about doing this slightly different? They're not dumping the cart over. They're just looking at on the margins, how might we do this slightly differently to better reward the relational longitudinal care of primary care in support of the beneficiaries that we serve? And look, it's highly controversial because anytime you move money around, it doesn't matter.
Moving somebody's cheese.
I mean, you know, if it's in our own homes or if it's in a program as big as Medicare, you know, there's going to be a few conversations about that and there's going to be some opinions. So we've been, you know, pretty forthright that we think that this is a good a good policy pursuit on their part. And to the extent that we can be helpful, we're going to continue to be helpful.
Well, you know, another interesting dimension that we've been following is the National Academy report towards implementing high quality primary care in the United States, which was led by some of your wonderful luminaries in the family practice discipline, variety of other people. And one of the final conclusions or recommendations was to really, and we've heard about this well, right, to really pay teams to take care of people, right? Not individuals necessarily. I think you've taken a somewhat different position about maybe pay some of the people on the team as part of a team, but not everybody in the same way, not a comprehensive team approach. What's your thinking on that, about how payment might be changed to really support team-based care and not any one group on the team?
Yeah, I think our position is probably somewhere in between what you just said, Margaret. I think we very much believe primary care is a team-based endeavor. We certainly think that physicians are a very, very important part of that, particularly for the high acuity illness patients. You need physicians engaged in and leading much of that care, but that doesn't mean that the other members of the team are not contributing in meaningful ways to the pursuit of health and disease management in those populations. We have a really simple position, which is there should just be a prospective per patient payment to take care of the individual and communities. And, you know, it's called a population-based payment. I'm old enough to just call it capitation. People get upset about that word, but it's really just a capitated payment. I think, you know, if we were a team of a healthcare team, like we can figure out how to take care of our patients probably better than some others. So just give us a capitated payment, give us a population to care for, and we'll figure out if we need a pharmacist or if we need a nurse, and we'll figure out how to do that the best way for our communities.
That's great. Margaret, you were talking a little earlier about the family practice being a young discipline, and certainly one that we salute here. One of our longest serving family physicians just retired after 45 years, graduated from a great program. So we have a long history. But not everybody may know exactly what we mean by family physicians. How do you define a family physician, and how does that differ from a primary care doctor?
Well, yeah, I mean, what a great question. So a family physician is trained comprehensively to provide for patients across the a spectrum of age and across a comprehensive subset of organ systems and disease states. Now, you know, all physicians in the United States are educated and trained to do procedures and surgery, but really what you're talking about is often referred to as the biopsychosocial model of healthcare. So the biological functions, the physiological functions and psychological functions and sociology. So a whole person, it's had lots of terms, whole person, comprehensive, wholeness, wellness, approach to healthcare. But really the way I summarize it, my father was a rural family physician. I just call it comprehensive care for people of all ages. And it's the ability to provide care, refer when the complexity or acuity of care is beyond their capabilities, and really be on a healthcare journey in both a physical and mental perspective with individuals and populations. And the beauty of family medicine, I give speeches on this all the time. I call it the plasticity of family medicine. They can really do anything to meet the needs of their population. So if that community needs them to do obstetrics, they can do obstetrics. If they need pediatric care, they can do pediatric care. But it's really a unique skill that family physicians have as compared to other physicians that tend to be age-specific, disease-specific, organ system-specific. I don't know where you want me to go with that, Mark. I can go all day.
Tell me a little bit about where your dad practiced and a little bit about his practice.
Yeah, so my dad practiced in rural Northwest Oklahoma. So if you were to draw a line between Wichita and Oklahoma City, a straight line, and then you went west about way too far, about 100 miles, he practiced out in the northwest corner, largely in a community called Enid, Oklahoma, but a number of surrounding towns. There were a few physicians out there. It's the typical story, right? There were a couple of family physicians, a surgeon, an anesthesiologist, and an obstetrician, and they just took care of, you know, everybody. People in about six surrounding counties. And it was not the best environment to grow up in, to have people just showing up at your house all the time. But as I got older and reflecting on it, it was just a beautiful way to take care of people and communities. And you know, he's a wonderful guy. He moved into academic medicine in the second half of his career, but for 20 years, he was in service to, you know, just an enormous group of people that were just, you know, they were mutually grateful for each other.
Well, we see in the community health center, the FQHC that's under our Moses Weitzman health system, we have patients who've been here pretty much as long as the organization has been around. Yeah. Three generation care. I think we might have four generation care. Yeah. In some ways. And that continuity, urban, rural, I think with a primary care practice is huge. But I want to ask you, about something that has really caught, I think, the imagination, the energy of many of our healthcare staff, physicians, nurse practitioners, dietitians, nurses, everybody else. And that's really lifestyle medicine. Food is medicine. And I know you have a new partnership with the Ardmore Institute of Health. I think that's to strengthen the role of primary care in addressing chronic conditions, which is certainly a part of that whole movement. Tell me about the relationship. What are you hoping to have happen, and what the what's the energy for that within your association?
Energy's high. I can answer that quickly. Energy's pretty high. There's a lot of interest in this kind of whole person health effort that we're driving. One of the things that we're doing that's unique from maybe the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and some others is Ardmore really asked us to work with them to incorporate lifestyle medicine, nutrition, food as medicine, some of these emerging practice types or practice interest areas, really thinking about how to merge them back into comprehensive primary care. So our job and our research and kind of education is really designed to take these concepts and multiply them through comprehensive or community-based primary care practices. How can just the average primary care practice in Connecticut incorporate lifestyle medicine into their clinic so that it doesn't have to be a specialty clinic or a full-time effort for them? It's just part of what they do. And the irony is it really is part of family medicine. I mean, family medicine was very much founded on these principles, many, many years ago. And, I love the energy behind it. So we're just kind of riding that wave and trying to help our members provide the best care they can to their patients.
Well, Margaret, we know a conversation isn't complete unless I weave in AI somewhere along the line. So let me try to do that. So some younger doctors say traditional medical associations are really not doing enough to engage social media and push back on misinformation. And for instance, we see Dr. Mike produces a very popular video and has criticized the AMA in his regards. And he's a family physician. So I'm wondering, how is the AAFP staying relevant in the era of TikTok and AI?
Yeah, I love Dr. Mike. He's a good family doc. I'm always careful with my fellow travelers. I think, the AMA needs to be strong and needs to be vibrant. And I mean, we work closely with them, trying to help them on this journey that we're all on together. But so we are very much committed to engaging content platforms that are relevant both to, our members, but also more importantly to the patients they care for. So we have public relations and media campaigns, but we are omni-channel. We have influencers spread across all the social media channels, including the ones I don't know. And, we provide them with content that is relevant to various audiences. A lot of that content is designed for physicians and healthcare professionals. A lot of it is designed for patients. But I think the most important thing I would tell you is we have centralized a hub called familydoctor.org where all patients can come back and get information, but they also can springboard out of familydoctor.org back to all of our social media content spread across multiple platforms. So I'm really, in fact, we just won a couple of awards for our vaccine campaigns. We were recognized for the content and efficacy of those campaigns. I'm really proud of the work we do in this space. It pains me to say I have reached the age where I can't speak with any coolness or confidence about some of these social media platforms, but I can speak confidently that we do it. So I'll just leave it at that.
You said cool versus hip, so you're okay.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us today, for the work that you're doing and the work of your members of the association. And thank you to our audience for being here. A reminder to be sure and subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.